Support for TPR comes from Texas Mutual Insurance Company, a workers' comp provider committed to helping employers get their people home safely. Preventing workplace accidents protects families and keeps businesses productive. More at texasmutual.com.
From the John L. Santikos Studio, this is The Source on Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. Your kitchen table is a long way from the Donbas region of the Ukraine, but they are linked because of the conflict between Russia and Ukraine. It's shaking up your kitchen table, and it's been contributing to the rise in global food prices. We're seeing the highest food prices in decades. In Ukraine, post-COVID, broken immigration system, global warming are all pushing inflationary prices up, but so too private corporations. I mean, they are making astronomic profits right now. So what's up with that? How is this impacting your family? Are you able to belt tighten out of this? Give us a call. How are you dealing with inflation and food prices right now? The number is 833-TPR-TALK, 833-877-8255. And you can text us at that number. You can include your name in that text message so we can give you a shout out. Also, tweet at us at TPRSource. Email us at thesource@tpr.org. We're joined by Mike Mitchell, Director of Policy and Research at the Groundwork Collaborative. And Mike Mitchell, welcome to The Source.
Thank you for having me.
Also with us is Russell Bayling, is the president of the Texas Farm Bureau, Farmers and Ranchers in Wilson County, just south of San Antonio. And Russell Bayling, welcome to The Source.
Thank you, David.
So, Russell, what are you seeing out there? So people say, why is there no food? Why is food prices so expensive? What's happening with the produce and my produce section? And so we got to look at the people, the farmers, and see what they're dealing with. Because if you're seeing it at the store, then you know the farmers are stressed out.
Well, you're right. And, you know, I think it's really a combination of a lot of things. You know, we talk about inflation, and I know leading off your program talked about, well, really, what is inflation? And, you know, I guess I kind of fall back on one of the main things that's driving this is fuel. Basically everything in this country moves by either truck or rail, and most of it by truck. And fuel prices have just, well, basically doubled in a year, you know, maybe a little over a year and a half. You know, we're seeing it on our end too. Our input prices have in some places doubled, some places tripled, whether we're talking about fertilizers, you know, machinery cost and those type of things. Yes, we're definitely seeing it on our end too. It's not only hitting the consumer, but it's for sure hitting the producer as well.
All right, so let's isolate and look at fuel prices for a moment here. Mike Mitchell at the Groundwork Collaborative. Some people have used the word greedflation to talk about where we are right now. As we talk about fuel and the petroleum corporations, they're making a lot of money right now. So what do you see happening why fuel prices are so expensive?
Sure. So you're absolutely right that we have seen a significant increase in fuel prices over the past year. And a part of that, of course, is due to geopolitical concerns, the war in Ukraine with Russia. But another part of that is we're dealing with an industry where there are very few agents in terms of oil companies, and the incentives that the oil companies are facing are very distorted. So if there was a great survey done by the Dallas Fed a few months ago where they asked CEOs of oil companies, why aren't you drilling more? Demand is high. Why aren't you drilling more and actually expanding supply? And the CEOs came back, and in that survey they say the number one reason that they are not drilling more is because their shareholders do not want them to. Their shareholders right now in this moment are demanding a return on their investment. And so they are going to constrain supply and keep costs high. So that is one of the places where you can see that greed, the desire to boost profits, and we're seeing, you know, fantastic profits for oil companies in this current moment, is driving prices up for consumers, It's making things harder to afford for working families. And ultimately, it hurts our economy. It hurts people's pockets.
So corporations, oil companies realize, Mike, that they can make record more money producing less oil?
They can boost prices right now. They can increase profits simply by constraining supply. At a time when we could use more supply to help keep prices down, shareholders are saying, do not do that.
All right. So, Russell Boehning, I've heard a lot about corporate farming, buying out smaller farms, and that they are that it's become more an ag corporation world in terms of producing food in the United States. Is that part of this as well?
I don't believe it's part of it, David. I mean, have farms and ranches and ag, you know, ag producers gotten larger over the years? Yes. You've kind of been forced into it. I mean, you know, we're a family corporation. You know, my parents, my brother, and myself, and of course the whole family, the spouses as well. And has everyone gotten larger? Yes. But 98% of the ag operations in this country are still family owned. Does that mean that they're not incorporated? No, of course not. I mean, that's a business decision that many operations make. I don't think that's what's driving this. Not at all.
Well, I hear that there's a labor problem as well, that it's harder to find workers for farmers. Is that true?
That is true. The labor situation has gotten tougher and tougher over the years. You know, there's folks that have maybe, you know, left certain enterprises that they used to work in that were more labor intensive. You know, so that has, you know, just on a personal note, we normally grow watermelons. And then this year we pretty much decided not to, just because of the difficulty in finding, reliable labor. So yes, that part of it is true.
So you need farm hands to do a lot of work when it comes to growing any product like cantaloupe, watermelon, broccoli, something like that. And you need people who can do the seed to sprout, to getting trays ready, to be able to put that into the machine that's going to put those things in the ground. That's a lot of intense labor that's got to happen.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir. And those are the products that probably suffer the quickest. You know, when you do have a labor shortage, you know, some of your more traditional Texas crops, and I don't know that, you know, and vegetables are traditional as well, but you know, corn, cotton, grain sorghum, wheat, much more mechanized. You know, you can do a lot of acres, and not have to rely on a lot of labor.
But a lot of the leafy greens, you got to have people to do that. And we're having a shortage of farmhands. And so we'll talk more about whether or not a broken immigration system is also one of the factors driving up the cost of food right now. We're going to take a quick break. Our phone lines are open, and we definitely want to hear from folks. I mean, what was it like when you went to make the groceries this weekend? Did you have to come home with less and pay more than you were expecting? Call in. The number is 833-877-8255, 833-TPR-TALK. We'll be back in 1 minute. Source on Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies, and we're talking about inflation. What is driving up the cost of everything? How is this really hitting people at the grocery store? you know, your kitchen table? How are people dealing with this? Are you doing what they call belt tightening? How much tighter can that belt get? Give us a call. The number is 833-877-8255, 833-TPR-TALK. We're now joined by Celia Cole, CEO of Feeding Texas, statewide nonprofit and the largest anti-hunger organization in Texas with 21 food bank partners. And Celia Cole, welcome to The Source.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So I can imagine that this is bad news for what you do, because a lot more people are in need, and it's a lot harder for you to find product to give them. Is that what's happening?
Yeah, it's a combination of things. I mean, I think the most important thing, too, to keep in mind is that even before the pandemic hit, before the current kind of inflation and supply chain crises, that, you know, 1 in 7 Texas families struggled with food insecurity, and that obviously spiked during this pandemic. But yeah, we're seeing consistently high demand right now. A couple things are fueling that: clearly higher costs, not just food, but gas and rent, forcing people to find ways to stretch their resources even more. If you think of like a family budget as a juggling act with a lot of balls in the air, the food ball's often the easiest to drop. You can cut back on the cost of food in a way you can't cut back on the cost of your rent. And so we're definitely seeing more people in lines at our food pantries for help as a result of those higher costs. And then, you know, you're also seeing the expiration of some of those pandemic benefits that really helped low-income Texans weather the crisis.
So, how are people dealing? Are they coming to the food bank? Are we seeing more pressure on the local food banks, Celia?
Yeah, we are definitely. So at the same time that those higher costs are affecting individual families, they're also affecting food banks. So we're seeing it cost more to get food. We're seeing less donations, fewer donations, both fewer food donations and financial donations. The cost of doing business has gone up for food banks tremendously because of rising fuel costs. So obviously, it's not just about obtaining the food. Even when it's donated, it costs us to get that food out into our community. So just fueling our trucks has become really challenging. So at the same time that our donations are either going down or leveling off, we're seeing more and more people needing our help.
Mike Mitchell at the Groundwork Collaborative, what sense can people make of this situation? Particularly if they work in, I'm hearing that if you are a shrimper, you're actually getting less money for what you produce, but yet it's selling for more at the grocery store. Someone is making additional profits. Where is that money going?
Sure. So let's, for example, focus on let's focus on like meatpacking. If you look at the meatpacking industry, you have essentially four companies that control a pretty large share of the whole industry. And because of the market power that these kinds of corporations have, they can do two things. One, they can charge a premium, especially in this current moment where we see prices rise broadly. It gives them a cover to increase prices even more. And two, when they're dealing with their suppliers, so ranchers and other folks, they can often enter into very beneficial agreements, because there is no other alternative for these suppliers to be able to find another buyer. So just because we have this high level of consolidation in this one particular industry, it ends up meaning higher costs for consumers, less money for the suppliers, and the meatpacking companies take all that money for themselves. So it creates a lot of hardship, and really the only folks that benefit are the meatpackers. More broadly, you can see other actors across the food chain, that are also benefiting. So you can see companies such as Kroger. Over the past year, the CEO of Kroger has been quoted as saying, a little bit of inflation is always good in our business. And Kroger made $132 billion last year, while their workers were making, on average, about 8% less. So you can see ways in which, either through market concentration or by being at the right place in the supply chain, this current environment is driving up prices for consumers, squeezing workers, squeezing suppliers.
Russell Boehning at the Texas Farm Bureau, president. If you could, does that sound right from what you're hearing here in Texas from Mike Mitchell saying that producers aren't really seeing the profits from this, even though the prices are going up?
Yes. I mean, I can agree partly with what Mr. Mitchell said. I mean, there's a lot of truth into what he said. I mean, the four major meatpackers do control 80% plus of the meat supply in this country. It's kind of drifted that way over the years because of different reasons. I mean, that's probably getting too far down in the weeds for today, but regulatory issues and things like that, and you know, bigger, you just have you know, economies of scale to a certain extent, but producers aren't seeing those prices, and that's true. Even though a lot of that's been supply and demand, we are seeing cattle prices improve over the past several months, back to just a little bit shorter supply. The pandemic contributed to that. We had a supply of beef that couldn't get through the chain, couldn't get so to speak, for different reasons. Plants had to shut down because of COVID protocols, or had to limit production because of COVID protocols. I'm not here to defend the meatpacking industry,
sure,
but they did deal with some issues that made it difficult. We talked about labor earlier.
Yeah,
of course, you know, it's a labor intensive industry as well. So, combination of things again.
I want to get back to labor in a little bit as well, but I'm going to get this caller on the air. We have Steven lined up. And Steven, you're on the air. Go ahead.
Yes, hello. I'm a local San Antonian foodie. I'm also an urban farmer. And I had a question about food production versus food consumption in the state of Texas. The Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change has encouraged us to create local and regional food systems. So I'm just wondering, what is the capacity of Texas to feed Texas? And then my other question to that is, with climate change and urban sprawl, what is the reality of us producing more food in our state?
And Stephen, hang on, I got a question for you. Okay, so typically right now, I would be like being able to live off of my backyard garden with so much stuff that would be growing, but everything is dead because of the extreme heat. So if, you know, we're having 100 degree plus days after day after day, I mean, and so that's not happening for me. So what are you seeing in terms of being able to produce food on an individual basis like that?
Yeah, with this drought, you know, one of the worst we've experienced in the past few years, it's making it more difficult for your hobby grower to be able to get the yields that they're used to. You know, there are some plants that we're trying to adjust to, like okra. They talk about the melons, summer squash, pomegranate, you know, are some that can take this heat, but it's becoming more difficult. And that's why I wonder, with climate change, how much more arable land is going to be available for us.
All right, Stephen, thank you. And let me get the answer to your question. Cecilia Cole, CEO of Feeding Texas. Any idea about local sustainability for Texas as far as being able to grow food?
Yeah, I think it's a critically important piece of sort of the anti-hunger ecosystem, is strengthening local food systems, giving people the tools to be able to grow their own food. You know, food banks do a lot in the way of partnering with growers in their communities, both to take advantage of surplus when they can't sell it, but also to support creating markets for local food, creating consumers for local food markets, supporting farmers markets. I think it's one of the most immediate ways to ensure that people can access food in their communities. I think, you know, one of the terms you hear a lot is food desert, and some call it food apartheid. But, you know, the challenge of people living in areas where there simply aren't grocery stores. And so one of the ways of addressing that can be to strengthen local food systems.
Mike Mitchell, I want to address also the fact that being able to have a yard and grow food, if you can, if the weather permits, that is, if you have a yard, if you have a house. A lot of people that live in apartments and rents are going up, people are being squeezed in that way. That's not an option for them. Is that something that we need to be thinking about?
Yeah, absolutely. I think, you know, absolutely to what was just said, that it can be a part of the ecosystem. It's an important part of the ecosystem. But at the end of the day, there will be some people who don't have the land, who don't have the time, who don't have the resources to be able to do that. And we are going to need larger corporate actors in, you know, the broader food, you know, supply chain system. So the question then is, how do you ensure that those actors are properly regulated and that they are playing by rules that make sure that when crises happen, such as a pandemic or other issues, that they don't have essentially kind of this ability to just raise prices as they're able to, such that, you know, folks endure more hardship, are struggling to make ends meet, to put food on the table for their families, for their kids. So I think that there just is a real critical need to make sure that in any given sector across, you know, our various food producers, that we have the proper regulations, we ensure the size of these corporations is not so outlandish that they have this market power to set prices at will.
Let's go to another caller. We have Fred on the line. And just 1 second. Fred, you're lit up. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Hello, sir. Thank you. I just wanted to point out I'm going through an immigration process. I filed my papers a year ago. I still have no response for my employment authorization. I'm a very qualified person. And, you know, there's jobs everywhere. There's a lack of cultural, but in every other branch, gastronomy. I'm thinking about people who've been here 20, 30 years as illegals. You know, they've made their way through. They have families. And still, this is a government and an immigration system that's so broken that it's not allowing them to enter legally into the system, to pay taxes, to have a social. You know, and we have a democratic government. Last government defunded totally the USCIS, but now we have a president who's a Democrat, and we still don't see any advance on it, which is, you know, kind of ironic.
All right, Fred, thank you for that call. And so in about a minute that we have left before we go to break, I want to go back to Russell Baining to talk about labor. We do have people who are on the other side of the Rio Grande who want to come into this country and work and become good Americans. They want to do it, you know, but is that something that would be a solution for the agri industry?
Well, the short answer there, David, is it would go a long ways to help solve the problem, to be part of the solution for sure. I think the caller that just called in, Fred just called in, and he hit some major points. I mean, really spot on. There are folks, there's no doubt, in many industries in this country, and not just agriculture, your service industries, and that have been here, not only folks on the other side of the Rio Grande or from other countries, that have been a productive person in this society. And we need to figure out a way for the folks that want to work and bring skills. Like I said, my point, you know, I've been in agriculture 40 plus years, but it's not just agriculture. These folks bring a lot of things to the table, and our immigration system is broken. And that kind of translates into our labor situation being broken as well. So, yes, I think a good first step would be a comprehensive immigration labor situation solution.
All right, we're going to go to break right now. We're going to continue talking about inflation, the cost of food, rent, fuel. That's a big part of the consumer price index, and it is growing beyond what meager wage increases are being offered out there. Meanwhile, we're still coming out of the COVID economy, and we're having many, many people who have long COVID who are now disabled and they can't work. So what's happening, and who do we blame? How do we fix it? We need a fix. The number is 833-877-8255. This is The Source. We'll be right back.
Support for TPR comes from Texas Mutual Insurance Company, a workers' comp provider committed to helping employers get their people home safely. Preventing workplace accidents protects families and keeps businesses productive. More at TexasMutual.com.
Welcome back to The Source on Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. If you went to the grocery store this weekend, you're probably still suffering from sticker shock. I couldn't believe how much just a can of Spam has gone up, and Spam is back on the menu, Spam tacos, because, you know, meat, protein, it's getting more expensive. Everything's more expensive. The produce section's looking a little pitiful out there, is because we're seeing so many pressures on the retailer. And they are trying, they're not, you know, they got to stay open too. Everybody is dealing with the cost increases for fuel, for rent, for everything else. How are you dealing with inflation? Who do you blame? What questions do you have about why the prices are going up? You can give us a call. The number is 833-877-8255, 833-TPR-TALK. And we have Hector on the line. Hector, you're on the air. Go ahead.
Hi. I work for a company called Ozone Solutions. It's more like my comment is more like a fixed solution where chlorine and the cost of chemicals is getting up higher. And the transportation, as you know, gas is getting up higher as well. Companies like poultries and like Tyson chickens need chlorine and other kind of chemicals to purify the chicken as the processing plant goes through. What my company does is that we use ozonated water and ozonated air to clean the bacteria, which cause the levels of the chlorine and chemicals less. So it's really a fix it to the today's situation, where tomorrow we need to take awareness of this. So what other solutions out of the box are we doing to use it in a non-chemical application and stop using waste, money, and things of that nature.
So, Hector, rephrase, I'm not really sure your question. Tell me again.
Outside of the box thinking on non-using chemicals, the cost of chemicals is getting up higher.
Okay. All right, Hector, thank you for that. So, Russell Boehning, as the Texas Farm Bureau president, people are looking, all the inputs, the fertilizer and things that are required for farming and ranching, are they turning towards different methods when the chemicals become so expensive?
Well, you know, you can maybe switch. You know, you for instance, if we're going to do weed control in a crop, you have a couple of options. It can be chemical control or what we call mechanical control, but mechanical control involves more fuel and those type of things. So you kind of get caught between the rock and the hard place. You know, yes, your chemicals have increased in price. Availability has been a problem on some of them. Not only, you know, if you need it bad enough, you'll pay just about anything. But if you can't get it, really doesn't make any difference what it costs, right? So I guess, yes, there are some options. I mean, when you start looking at those things, fertilizer prices have really, really increased. But what do you do? You have a lot of other costs involved in raising that crop. If you don't spend the money on fertilizer or chemicals to take care of it, then you really, for lack of a better term, shot yourself in the foot, so to speak. So yeah, there's different things you can do, but really the cost of production has gone up, period, no matter what you do.
Celia Cole, CEO of Feeding Texas. In addition to working with food banks, you know, you're 21 of them here in Texas that you work with, and you're the largest anti-hunger organization in the state. Are you coaching maybe households on how to get through this, how to work with their budget, maybe finding alternatives to what they can cook?
Yeah, I mean, to the extent that we can, really. I mean, a dollar is a dollar. It only goes so far, and particularly with, you know, rising food prices, I think it's really challenging for families to find, you know, effective ways to cut back. But we do run a statewide nutrition education programs, and one component of that is budgeting, food budgeting, and helping families figure out how to stretch their food dollars. But then, you know, we're also focused on finding ways to increase resources for families for food through government policy change.
But, you know, there are different cuts of meat or parts of a chicken that don't normally, you know, so it used to be, you know, tossed aside. But with a little creative cooking know-how and borrowing from, you know, my grandmother's cookbook from during the Depression, you know, those things become, you know, valuable sources of nutrients.
Yeah, I mean, I think families who are low income are used to being creative about stretching limited resources, and they probably don't need our help telling them to buy the lower cost cut of meat. And I think one of the challenges, obviously, when you do cut back on food or you have less resources for food, is that you often end up eating foods that are less healthy and less nutritious. And that, you know, is a problem that we see. It's we know that a lot of the people who come to food banks for help are really struggling to afford the kind of food that's necessary to be healthy. That leads to health problems and sort of that exacerbates the resource problems even further.
And particularly people with diabetes.
Right. People with any kind of diet-related illness. You know, our food banks run what we call food RX programs because food is medicine. And we partner with healthcare to diagnose food insecurity and make referrals to food banks to help people with diabetes and hypertension and other diet-related illness access the kind of foods they need to be healthy but don't always have the resources for.
So Mike Mitchell from the Groundwork Collaborative, I mean, you mentioned the fact that Kroger was saying that a little bit of inflation is good for us. But, you know, for decades, they have said that a little bit of inflation in the economy is an overall positive. And that's from, you know, John Maynard Keynes, his point of view. But they maintained inflation at about 2%, and now but that really didn't work out well for workers because the wages didn't keep up, minimum wage didn't keep up over the years, and now they're wondering even now if we do get inflation under control, that 4% inflation could become the target for an annual to tolerate in the system. And there are people who argue that actual inflation is good for people who don't have assets because if you don't have money in savings, then you're not seeing your money evaporated. That it's harder on the middle and upper middle class than it is on the working class. Your reaction?
Mm-hmm. Sure. So I would say that, you know, discerning the winners and losers of inflation can be complicated depending on where people sit. But broadly, when you have high bouts of inflation, people with lower incomes are going to feel it the most. They're going to feel it when they go to the gas station to fill up their tanks. They're going to feel it when they go to the grocery stores. They're going to feel it as prices rise to just, you know, to exist in a home with paying rent. So we can say that on average, lower income folks, other marginalized communities, folks of color, are going to feel bouts of inflation more broadly. The other way, though, that families are going to feel inflation is when we talk about our policy solutions. Right now, you have a lot of conversation around how the Federal Reserve can raise interest rates or continue to raise interest rates to help get inflation under control. The issue with that, however, is that this is a very blunt policy tool. And the risk that the Federal Reserve opens up is that either they really dampen demand, and what I mean there is that they slow down wage growth, or they risk pushing us towards a recession. Now, both of those things, again, dampening wages will hurt working folks primarily, first and foremost, and a recession, you know, folks at the bottom end of the income spectrum will feel a recession more likely. You're talking about folks losing their jobs. The alternative to this, however, is policymakers, lawmakers on the Hill, taking responsibility and ensuring that folks have the things that they need to make ends meet. So we just had this pandemic where one of the strongest policy responses was stimulus checks. This and the child tax credit, expanding the child tax credit and making it a monthly benefit for a temporary period of time. We saw poverty fall. We saw hardship, certain measures of hardship, actually fall by taking proactive measures to help families make ends meet. Those are the kinds of solutions that are going to help folks as we see prices rise. And then you can take the other steps, like I was talking about earlier, making sure that corporations are playing by the rules, making sure that we break up large corporations so that they don't have outlandish market power, and then making the kinds of investments in, say, our supply chain, physical infrastructure, other kinds of infrastructure that actually allow for goods to get to market and help to address some of the supply side issues that are raising prices right now. If we don't do those things, the next time we have a crisis, we will be right back in the spot. And so we need lawmakers to act and not solely rely on federal, on the Fed for interest rate hikes.
There are people, economists and people on those business channels who say that those checks that were provided as a response to COVID is what's driving inflation right now.
Yeah, I would say that for folks who are arguing that, there is a growing amount of research that we're seeing right now that is saying that the American Rescue Plan was not the largest or primary driver of rising costs right now. And I'm not saying that it was not a driver. I'm saying that there are multiple factors taking place right now. One of them may be that we have supply chain issues that are caused primarily by the pandemic. Well, okay, then how do we address that? We've got to make sure that we have robust supply chains that are capable of making sure that goods can get from whoever is supplying these goods to stores where people can purchase them. If that can't happen and there are shortages, prices are going to go up. We also have to look at market power. When corporations have a certain market cornered and they can raise prices as they want to, that's going to raise prices.
All right, we got to take a break. We'll come back. We'll continue discussing what's driving up these food costs and how can we fight back. The number is 833-877-8255, 833-TPR-TALK. It's The Source on Texas Public Radio. Source on Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. Our topic today, inflation and food costs, something we all know too much about because we're seeing it whenever we got to go to the store to fill up that grocery basket, and that basket is not getting filled up, but our wallets are being drained trying to figure out how we're going to feed our families. The number is 833-877-8255. We have Laura on the line. Laura, you're on the air. Go ahead.
Hi. One answer that comes to mind in terms of supply and protein needs is this issue of some of the invasive wildlife that we have in our state anyway, locally, like axis deer and hogs, that there are many hunters out there. There are many hunting leases out there that these hunters have access to all year round, but there's no market for because there's no legality. What would it take to, increase the supply or use those species that would create good protein for people like axis and boar to increase, to put that into the market or at least to be able to have the opportunity of donating it to the food bank or something?
Laura, thank you for that call. Celia Cole, CEO of Feeding Texas. What can you tell Laura?
Yeah, Laura, great question. So we have a program called Hunters for the Hungry that supports farmers in donating, hunters donating venison. And actually our San Antonio Food Bank has its own meat processing facility to support that program. So we really welcome donations of venison. We work with processors across the state to help, so the hunters can drop off a donation and get it processed for distribution by the food bank. Hogs are harder for us because they have to be trapped live and tested for, pork-borne illnesses. So we haven't tapped that yet, that supply. But definitely the venison is a really important source of lean and nutritious protein for our network.
Right. So hunters, if you bring your legally tagged, field dressed wild game to the San Antonio Food Bank's processing facility, they will take care of it at no cost for you. And when you purchase your Texas hunting license, you can choose the option to donate to the hunters, to the hungry, and your donation will support this as well. Let's go to Frank on the phones. And Frank, you're on the air.
Hi. My question is, I don't know. It just seems very, like, strange to me that there are no investigations going on. Once in a while, you hear Warren and Klobuchar say they're going to look into, you know, antitrust type stuff, you know, price gouging, and nothing happens. Is this, you know, is there anything like that going on where these gas companies aren't just taking advantage of stuff and there's price gouging?
All right, Frank, thank you for that great question. Mike Mitchell at the Groundwater Collaborative, we've heard about maybe a windfall tax that could be passed to take care, maybe looking at the astronomic profits. What do you see?
Sure. So, you know, at the Groundwater Collaborative, we've seen a number of potential pieces of legislation that have gone down, that have been in the works on the Hill. So these measures are looking at things like price gouging. They're looking at prohibiting anti-competitive mergers. There, as you mentioned, we've had some conversations about windfall profits taxes. And these are all important solutions that lawmakers can and should be considering and moving forward, right? I think, though, even before these things, we can just look to the laws that are currently on the books and continue to urge the federal government, the FTC, state attorneys general to be investigating and using current authority that they have to crack down on extractive and exploitive business practices. So I think these additional pieces of legislation are important, and there has been some activity. But there are things that we can do with the current powers that lawmakers and other officials have to address some of these issues.
Russell Boehning, president of the Texas Farm Bureau, and you've got land out here in Wilson County just south of San Antonio, and you've been feeling the heat just like all of us. Is the drought and the heat and global warming, is that impacting food production?
Well, it's definitely impacting food production in Texas right now. There's no doubt about that, David. The drought is, you know, pretty prevalent over at least 2/3 of the state. And, you know, there's parts of East Texas that are, in pretty good shape. But you could pretty much say the western 2/3 is. And then, of course, the heat. 100-degree days from mid-July to mid-August are pretty common. From the end of May to mid-June, you know, aren't that common. And you guys know that as well, but it's definitely impacted things in South and in the western part of the state for sure. And I'll lump it in the panhandle. Spots, small areas have caught some moisture. But when you combine the heat with the lack of rainfall, it's pretty dire situation right now.
So are we looking at a blip in the timeline here, Russell, or are we looking like we need to make some real adjustments into what our expectations for food availability are? Some people are saying that we're living through a food shortage. What are your thoughts?
Well, we people have asked me, when's the last time you remember it like this, this dry? And I remember it well, 2011. Was the last time we were this dry. I'm using my area and other parts of the state I don't think we were as hot this early in 2011, but we can prove that. We can prove me right or wrong pretty easily. I know that. I haven't looked it up. Food shortages, I've been asked that question repeatedly. Is it possible you're going to go to the grocery store and find certain items that you want to buy and they'll be either not there or a very limited supply? Yes, that's possible. Our food supply is resilient enough that I truly believe you won't go to the grocery store and and find the staples that you need to have a healthy diet. So that's my stance on this. Is it going to cost more? Well, yeah, it's obvious it's going to cost more. I mean, everybody can find these figures. You know, meats, poultry, and fish are up 13%. Eggs are up 32%. Dairy almost 12%. I mean, those are things that are staples, but they are there. I'm not minimizing what it's doing to the consumer. I'm not at all. We're in a kind of a tough spot right now.
And we only time will tell if this is permanent or just a momentary thing. But Cecilia Cole, I want to dedicate a couple of minutes as we're running out of time to thinking about how this looks globally. So we're in a privileged position in the United States, but around the world, not so much. They are having food shortages in other parts of the world. I mean, is that something we need to be thinking about?
Yeah, for sure. Definitely, when there are challenges in the global food supply chain, it might hurt the most in those areas with food shortages, but it trickles down to hurt, you know, people here at home. And I really, you know, here in Texas, I want to harken back to something about whether people can find food or going to have challenges finding food. You know, people aren't coming to food banks because they went to the grocery store and couldn't find food. They're coming to food banks because they went to the grocery store and couldn't afford food. And hunger's not a food problem. It's a money problem for people. And just to thinking about something Michael said earlier about the child tax credit, the quickest way to address hunger is to put money into people's pockets. And that's exactly what you saw with the expanded child tax credit. So it's a global problem, hunger, and it requires global solutions. But focusing on what's going on here at home, people simply do not have the resources to afford food right now.
Mike Mitchell, I'm thinking about the book. I don't know if you know this or not, the Shock Doctrine, The Rise of Disaster Capitalism by Naomi Klein. And she talks about how there's this Milton Friedman playbook of, like, when there's bad times, that's when you make big profits. When you have unrestrained capitalism in play here. And is that something that you think about?
Absolutely. We're talking about a moment in time where corporate profits last year increased, profit margins were at, you know, some of the highs that they've been in the past 70 years. Last year, corporations saw profits increase by 35% over the year prior. This is in the middle of a pandemic. The vast difference between the well-being of, you know, the ultra wealthy and, you know, regular working class folks has not been this yawning in its divide in a long time. And it means more hardship right now for everyday working class folks than it has, in a long period of time. And so I think without addressing the outsized power that corporations play across our economy and what that outsized power then means for impacts on our democracy, I think we run the risk of everyday working people, you know, continuing to feel like they have a place in the economy, they have a place in society, and that ultimately jeopardizes the health and safety of this country.
And in 30 seconds, what should people do about that?
Well, I think, you know, at the Groundwork Collaborative, we focus on three things. First is continuing to build public power. So one of the things that I think a number of folks have talked about here is the ability for workers to be able to engage with employers to make sure that their wages are growing in good times. And this makes sure that more people can, weather the storm during bad times, right?
Right.
The ability to access food banks or other things is critical. And then I think addressing corporate power is really critical as well.
All right. Mike Mitchell is the Director of Public Policy and Research at the Groundwork Collaborative. We heard from Russell Boehning, President of the Texas Farm Bureau. He's got farms and ranches in Wilson County to south of San Antonio, and Cecilia Cole, CEO of Feeding Texas. This is The Source on Texas Public Radio. Thanks for listening.
This has been The Source on Texas Public Radio. The Source is hosted by David Martin Davies, produced by Dallas Williams, with production assistance provided by Jackie Velez and Steve Short. Dan Katz is TPR's news director. Support for The Source comes from contributors to the Community Engagement Fund, including the Gladys and Ralph Lazarus Foundation.